Okay, folks, welcome to the latest chapter, the latest edition, the latest thrilling episode, I should say, of Life on Planet Porky with myself, the Porkmeister, and, of course, the rock chick writer extraordinaire, Ms. Leslie Ann Jones. And Leslie Ann, I think I have to say immediately, it's the first chance we've had to come to air since a national tragedy occurred, and that is the death of Captain Tom. Somewhat a somber start, but a man to whom I feel we both would like to pay tribute.
Absolutely. I was very sad about it, actually. I shed a few tears over this. I know he was 100 years old. Yes, I did. Yeah. I don't cry very often, but this did move me. Yeah, he was 100. Yes, he was unwell. He was battling prostate cancer. Yeah. He had pneumonia, so they weren't able to vaccinate him against COVID. What happened is that he became the first COVID martyr, because he literally gave his life for this cause. So all the deniers out there who are still saying COVID doesn't exist, you know, I'm not having the vaccination. Yep. If you can't do it for yourself, do it for him in tribute. That's what I would say.
Yes. But even so, you still got these sick-minded people who go onto social media and start, you know, berating him, slagging him off. And even one churchman who said, oh, he's just a sign of white supremacy, which I thought was a shocking and bloody awful thing for anybody who wears a dog collar and is a man of the church to get involved in. You know, most of the world not only has great affection for Captain Tom, but believes he did an awful lot of good for an awful lot of people.
Yes, he did. And I think we won't even dignify that with a comment, will we? It's just not worth it. But I mean, look, I think it'll raise a huge amount more money now that he's dead, because this always happens. You know, a lot of people will be regretful that they didn't pay him much attention during that final year of his life, when he achieved more in one year than most people do in their entire lifetimes. You know, a number one hit, Guinness Book of Records, knighted by the Queen, just extraordinary.
Piers Morgan's life stories.
I mean, there you go. Such a humble man, and completely taking it all in his stride, although he'd never had experiences like this before, apart from the fact that he won blankety blank, didn't he, years ago?
Yeah, that's right.
Was very sweet.
Yeah.
Did you go out clapping in his honour?
Well, I didn't, but I clapped indoors. And the reason I didn't go out clapping is because nobody in my street went out clapping. It wasn't like the early days of the NHS and all that. And I thought, how weird is that? So I didn't want to, you know, just really seem foolish. But it was 6 o'clock and I walked around my apartment clapping, honestly, and remembering him. I did.
I went out with the kids. We all stood on the kind of by the front gate, you know.
Yeah, lovely.
There was nobody else out there. It was dark and we were clapping away enthusiastically. And then when we stopped, we heard one other person sort of way up the road clapping, but we couldn't see them. Yeah. But then we went back indoors and watched it on television. It was very moving.
Yeah, it was indeed. And of course, it was my father and mother's generation. My mum died a couple of years ago now, but she knew all about the values that you had to adapt when you grew up during the war years, when your house was getting bombed by the Luftwaffe on the banks of the River Mersey. Literally, that's what happened to my mum. And my father, of course, fought in the war. He joined up when he was 17 in 1940. He had a six-year war at sea. Captain Tom fought in the Burma War. That was a dirty, dirty war. And he never spoke much about it, because the men who fought in that, what was called the Lost Army campaign, they often didn't speak of the privations because they were so terrible.
My uncle, who was Bertrand Russell Jones, named after the great philosopher, went off to Burma and died a horrible death there in the swamps. And I remember my father telling me that Big Daddy, who was my great-grandfather, the father of 10 children, five boys, five girls, Big Daddy stood on the doorstep of their cottage in Wales, waving goodbye to Uncle Bert, and turned to his wife, Granny Annie, and said, "We won't see him again."
No, I'm afraid that was the story. And all that's very emotional stuff, isn't it? And that's the sort of thing that that Captain Tom represented. Now, talking about COVID, Miss Jones, today is the day of my great adventure. I'm going to walk across the North Downs to Epsom Racecourse this evening, and I'm going to ask if I can have a spare vaccine left behind by somebody who didn't turn up, because otherwise, having been brought out of cold storage, it would have to be thrown away.
good for you. And that is a very noble thing to do, to use up sources of this vaccine that might otherwise go to waste.
Yeah.
And also to protect yourself, because you are vulnerable. And I'm actually surprised that you haven't been called up for it before.
Well, I'm a bit surprised about that. I'm also a bit surprised, really, that there's not more restriction on people going into work. You know, I go into work at what I call Talk Radio Towers. It's the UK News Centre at London Bridge. And there's a lot of people there on a Saturday afternoon because of football matches and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, it's completely voluntary. You know, nobody's making you go into work. I'm not saying that for a moment. Completely voluntary. And I want to go in because I want to enjoy the atmosphere of the studio and the control room and the camaraderie. If I didn't want to go in, they'd very happily allow me not to. So I'm not in any way putting the blame on my employers. I'm saying that because it's available and it's there, I do it. You know what I mean? But I'm surprised they still let you.
Are they going to fantastic lengths to sterilise the microphones and all the equipment and so on?
Absolutely. Everything is one person in the control room, one person in the studio, one person in the loos, you know, in the bathrooms. I mean, it is all 111 and they do it very well. But, you know, it's getting there and back bit as well, isn't it, really, about, you know, moving around.
Yeah, you're taking a risk on public transport. You really are.
Well, are you? Because most of the coaches now are empty. I don't touch anything. I don't touch the rails. I don't touch a table. I sit in a seat and I don't touch anything. And I get on and I get off. So I don't think there is a huge risk on public transport. There would be if it was a... Now, that's a good point, because at some stage of the journey, sometimes, depending on which day I'm working, I have to get a tube. And those tubes frighten me. They are full, believe me.
But you just said that you sit on the train. So you are touching things. Part of your body, your clothing, is touching the seat, the back of the seat behind you.
Yeah.
And the virus can live on your clothes. I read a story this week of somebody who contracted COVID and died. Yeah. They traced it back to the fact he used a pen in a hospital to fill in his form. Mm. And he caught the COVID from the pen.
Good God. I mean,
so you've got to be really careful. Your clothes are touching all of those parts of the train.
Most of my clothes get washed after one day's use anyway. Well, I suppose my jacket doesn't. You're absolutely right. You don't wash your jacket every day if you've got a jacket on. Yeah, well, it's, you know, I shake things down when I come in, to be honest. I go to the back door, to the garden, I shake them up and all that. I'm very fastidious. Everything I buy in a supermarket gets wiped down with the disinfected cloth before it's taken out of the bag, you know. But anyway.
Be careful on those trains for
something,
me.
Something we just have to live with at the moment. Now, I'll tell you what fascinated me, Leslie Ann, and has done for years, and revival with Don McLean's great record, The Day the Music Died, American Pie. Buddy Holly was killed on this week back in 58 or 59 when he was just 22 years of age. How had he risen to such incredible worldwide prominence and become the inspiration for 60s, 70s and 80s stars at just the age of 22?
Well, he hadn't, of course, until he died. This was the point. The tragedy was what projected him to international stardom. Yeah. At that point, he was just doing this Midwest winter dance party with a few other bands. Yeah. The Big Bopper was on it, Dion and the Belmonts and so on. They were not international stars at this stage, but it was the actual plane crash that projected them to stardom, because it was such a horrific thing that happened.
Yeah,
lots of conspiracy theories about what happened at the time of the crash and so on. The tragedy of that for me, of course, it was awful that these musicians were wiped out, but there were two fathers-to-be on that flight. Buddy Holly's wife, Maria, was pregnant, and the pilot's wife was pregnant as well,
really?
Roger Peterson.
Yeah.
And awfully sadly, Buddy Holly's widow and his mother learned about his death from a TV report. They weren't even told first. And his wife, Maria, collapsed and miscarried the baby, which was another tragedy on top of what had already happened.
Indeed. Peggy Sue, Peggy Sue, a Peggy, 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 Peggy Sue. See, I thought they were worldwide hits, and that's why...
Yeah, they became worldwide hits, didn't they? But it wasn't the case at that stage. But, you know, it's like anything else. A rock star dies at whatever stage.
Yeah.
The best thing, my friend Simon Napier-Bell, he's a famous band manager, looked after the Yardbirds and Wham and George Michael as a solo artist, and he always says the best thing a rock star can do is die young.
Yeah.
Because you're preserved then. Your legacy, your mystery is yes. then set in stone and you're never going away. Yeah. So your album sales, your single sales go through the roof.
Yeah.
And I think it's because there can be no more. It's a finite yes. amount of material. There can't be any more because you've gone.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I totally agree with all of that you say. Well, moving from Buddy Holly to what naturally would be the Beatles, because, of course, Paul McCartney still talks about Buddy Holly, doesn't he? I think he's recorded yeah. some of his songs, hasn't he?
Yeah, I mean, Buddy Holly was a great inspiration to them when they were starting yeah. out, and to many other musicians as well. I think they captured Buddy Holly and the Crickets. They captured that essence of 50s America,
yeah,
the
sure.
post-war hopes and dreams that infected the world.
Yeah,
yeah, it infected the world, didn't it?
And yeah, it did.
All we knew about America, we weren't born, but all that elsewhere in the world knew about America was what they knew from cowboy films,
yeah.
mostly. And
no,
it seemed like a
true.
Very exotic,
cowboy
distant
films
land.
And Superman. Yeah,
yeah,
yeah, it's true, yeah. And we spoke a couple of podcasts ago about men who wear glasses, don't make passes and all that. And I think...
Yeah, what was all that about? What did you mean on Twitter when you said, I wouldn't make passes at men who wear glasses?
Oh, well,
complete
you know...
Complete misquote, Porky, by the way.
Well, that's... a complete misquote is sometimes quite good because it makes people wonder a little bit, you know what I mean? But I was going to say that Buddy Holly made glasses famous, in my view, because pop stars didn't wear glasses in those days. The next guy to wear glasses after him was Peter Asher. Please lock me away and don't allow the day. That was written by Paul McCartney, wasn't it?
Peter and Gordon, who were, you know, again, a Beatles connection because Peter's sister, being Jane Asher, who
right.
dated Paul McCartney for many
yeah.
years.
Yeah.
And in fact, Paul McCartney lived in their house
yes.
in, I think, Wimpole Street, just off Harley Street.
It was, you're absolutely right, yeah.
And Peter and Jane's mother... was an oboe teacher, and she yeah. taught George Martin to play
yeah.
the oboe, George
yeah.
Martin being the Beatles producer.
Absolutely. I had a remarkable encounter. I think I may have told you this, I may not. I may have told the listeners this before. When I was writing a book, it was being done by a publishing company, and my editor was a guy called, I can't remember his first name now, but his second name was Scarf, S-C-A-R-F. It was Donald or something like that, Donald Scarf, okay? S-C-A-R-F-E. And so I go into the meeting with him, I'm talking, and then a colleague of his comes in and talking, and for some unknown reason, we got on to talking about the Beatles, you know? And he said, oh, well, you know who you're in the room with, don't you? And I said, yeah, I'm with you, and with Donald. He said, yeah, ask him who his mother is. This guy's mother was Jane Asher, who married the very, very famous cartoonist, Gerald Scarfe.
Ah, okay. Absolutely.
And,
yep.
and I was stunned. And I actually said, and I apologized later, I said, what? I said, so in a parallel universe, you could be Paul McCartney's son. He said, yes, in a parallel universe, but I'm not. I'm very grateful to be Gerald Scarfe and Jane Asher's son, you know?
Yeah, that's probably quite an offensive thing to say to him.
Well,
you know, your dad's no good. You'd have done much better with Paul McCartney.
Exactly. That's what I thought. I rang him up later and I said, look, Donald.
Sorry about that.
Yeah, I said, look, I'm sorry. I said, I've just been such a Beatle fan all my life. I'm sitting there looking at a man whose father could have been Paul McCartney, but wasn't. And it made it, so you're absolutely right. It made it sound like I'd said to this bloke, oh, golly, you really messed up your life. Well, your mother's messed up your life for you, hasn't she? You know.
Was, keep digging, Porky,
yeah,
is
exactly.
the answer to that, yeah.
Exactly. But anyway, listen, talking about rock stars, we can move on to another pop combo with whom you have very, very strong connections, and that, of course, is Queen, because you may have seen this morning, for music to make you feel better, Queen rule. And this says, if you're looking for a feel-good mid-pandemic boost, playing Queen's Don't Stop Me Now should do it. The 1979 single has been voted the tune most likely to put people in a better mood. It was followed by ABBA's Dancing Queen and Bon Jovi's Living on a Prayer, which I can't remember, and then Walking on Sunshine. I'm walking on sunshine.
Followed Katrina and the Waves, yeah.
Katrina and the Waves. And lastly, I'm giving her good vibrations. She's giving me the Beach Boys song, which drove them mad because it wasn't as good as Sergeant Pepper's, was it?
Well, there was all that rivalry going on between the Beach Boys and the Beatles at that time. And it was the Pet Sounds, Sergeant Pepper thing, wasn't it?
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
Trying
to
outdo each other. Yeah. But yeah, all of those are great dance tunes, aren't they? I think if you're a club disc jockey, if you're one of those travelling disc jockeys that we used to have for your party, you know, you'd have a party in a church hall and you'd hire a DJ and stuff.
Right.
The guy comes along, he knows what tracks to put on that everyone's going to jump up and dance to, and all of those I would have chosen. It's no big surprise, really. That song, the Queen song, Don't Stop Me Now, is actually quite a controversial song, I think, if you sort of take it away from the dancing aspect,
right?
Because really it was the song that was saying Freddie Mercury was doing everything in his life that basically was going to lead to the death of him.
Right.
He was overdoing it with the sex and drugs and rock and roll.
Right. And I see. So people were sort of warning him about his sort of rather populist behaviour, to for want of a better word. And they're all saying, come on, Freddie, you're going to burn yourself out and all that. And he wrote a song saying, don't stop me now. I'm having such a good time. I'm having a party.
Even a ball,
A ball, but, having a ball.
Yeah, Brian May has spoken about it at length, and he has said, look, you know, Freddie was doing a ton of drugs at that time.
Yeah.
He was sleeping with lots of men, and we were worried about him.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, well, their worries were well justified. And funny you should say that, because, of course, I have another story here which links to that. No one plotted to tear down the statue of Freddie Mercury that for 12 years adorned the entrance of the Dominion Theatre where Queen's We Will Rock You ran. But where is it? It has
I know
been
exactly
revealed.
Where it is. I know where it is.
Right,
it's in
okay.
Roger Taylor's back garden.
Well, it says exactly that, Miss Jones. You're ahead of the ball again. It says, it has been revealed that Queen drummer Roger Taylor has installed Freddie in his garden, saying of guitarist Brian May, I think Brian was very pissed off he hadn't thought of taking it himself.
There was a bit of controversy. This has been known for quite a long time. This is not news.
Right.
There is controversy because it is a very tall statue.
Yeah.
As you rightly say, it was above the Dominion Theatre entrance
for
the duration of their musical, We Will Rock You.
Yes.
And they didn't seek planning permission from Surrey Council before they installed it in the back garden.
Mm-hmm.
And they have had to do a retrospective application
to
be allowed to keep it there because it sort of towers above the fence, if you like.
Yes. Yes, I know what you mean, yeah. But that would be something to see, wouldn't it? I always wonder what happened to the Michael Jackson statue at Fulham, because Muhammad Al-Fayed struck up this very strange relationship, didn't he, with Michael Jackson. I mean, Muhammad Al-Fayed was so wealthy, he could strike up relationships with, you know, a lot of the world's famous people. But I went to an Everton game there one night after the club had been taken over by its current owner. I can't remember the name of the chap. I think his name is Khan, but he owns the Jackson Browns football franchise in America. And we all hung around in the boardroom afterwards, a few drinks and all that. And then Fulham is quite an odd sort of a ground. You have to walk round from one side to another to get out. It's a very comfy little ground, literally on
it's
the banks.
It's quite quaint there, isn't it?
It's very quaint. It's very
Craven Cottage, isn't it?
Craven Cottage, very quaint. And it's wedged between a park and the River Thames. So there's not many in and out entrances to it. And you have to all come in on one side off the road and then walk round the ground to where you want to go to. So I'm walking round from the sort of boardroom side, and I come down one side, then I come down the other, then I turn the corner to come finally towards the exit, and there's a huge like load of arc lights there and ladders and cherry pickers, and they were taking down the Michael Jackson statue. And I've no idea where it went, but it was such a bizarre sort of thing to see at 11 o'clock at night, you know, in Fulham in London.
Well, I tell you where it might be is in Muhammad Al-Fayed's back garden, because do you remember the grotesque statue of Diana, Princess Diana and Dodi Fayed?
Yes, I do. Yes.
In the front of Harrods as you went in there.
Yes.
That was removed from Harrods when he sold off his interest in the department store. And that made its way to his back garden in Surrey. So I bet he's got like a bit of a sort of Disneyland in the back garden there with all these statues of his former kind of, you know, nearest and dearest.
Yes, no, you could well be right. Now then, Ms. Jones, you and I are not unfamiliar with the broadcasting world, particularly the radio world. So you'll have seen this morning, I'm sure. The BBC is going Radio Gaga. And again, it's another reference to Freddie Mercury and a picture of Freddie Mercury, a very famous Queen song. Although I think that was written by the drummer, wasn't it?
Yes, Roger Taylor wrote that song, famously. Yeah. But they all wrote number ones. Every member of Queen had number one hits that they'd written. So all very talented songwriters.
Sure. But anyway, it says, as Radio 2 tunes out Baby Boomers by turning off 60s and 70s hits, a full blast from one of the station's legends. And there is your old pal, David Hamilton. David Hamilton, ruining the loss of what he says is a perfectly balanced radio station, Radio 2. What do you think?
Well, yeah, I think it's true. I think it's interesting the way we were so into Radio 1 when we were kids.
Yeah.
When Radio 1 started in 1967, do you remember the track they played, the very first track played on the new BBC Radio 1?
Was it by... hang on, it was Ray, what's his name? Roy, The Move. Was it The Move?
Yeah, you're getting there.
The Move. Was it Blackberry Way?
It was Flowers in the Rain.
Flowers in the Rain, that's it, yeah.
And it was so exciting because we were just kids, but you know, we'd had family favourites until then. There wasn't much radio for kids.
Yes.
And suddenly there was Radio 1. And it was such a thrill all through my childhood and youth, teenage years, the whole Radio 1 thing. Mm. And until along came commercial radio, at which point I got into Capital. Yeah. And I was a massive Capital radio fan.
Sure.
Used to go along to the best disco in town at the Lyceum Ballroom.
Well, you ended up working there, didn't you?
Yeah, I did, after I came out of college. But it's interesting that I'm now a Radio 2 aficionado.
Yes.
But Radio 2 doesn't actually play very much music that I'm into. So there is a gap here, and I do see what David Hamilton and his ilk are talking about.
Well, that's right. He's signed up with an organisation you and I have, been talking to, Boom Radio. And it says it's to plug that gap. And without a shadow of a doubt, there is a demand for the music that we're talking about, 60s and 70s. I love it. You know, when I finished work each day, I usually wrap things up, if I can, about 3, 3.30. And then, you know, open a beer, settle down in the kitchen, put the radio on. Well, you know, you put it through your system these days. And I always go for, like, greatest hits or something like that, you know. So I think there is... definitely an opening there, and obviously we wish any new enterprise great success.
Absolutely, because there is, I mean, you can get a playlist, as you say, you can go, Alexa, you know, play me some 60s hits or whatever.
Yes, you can.
It's not the same thing as having a presenter who has done things the old-fashioned way and has mounted a program, put together a selection of hits which have a connection in some way, and people like to second-guess DJs and wonder what they're going to lead into and play next and that kind of thing. And there's also that thing of haven't heard it for ages.
Yes.
You wouldn't necessarily choose to play certain tracks.
Yes.
But the presenter suddenly comes up with something. You think, wow, I haven't heard that in such a long time. I'm really pleased to hear that track. Obviously DJs still have their value. And to be congratulated. Good on David Hamilton.
Yeah, totally. One of those tracks you're talking about, it's one of the greatest records I think ever, is Thunderclap Newman, Something in the Air. Whenever that comes on, I love it. And I think I love it because I hear it so rarely. Whereas, of course, a lot of hits from the 60s and 70s are played over and over and over again. You know what I mean? You know, things like ABBA tunes and all that. But I so rarely hear Thunderclap Newman and that fantastic piano riff in the middle. But anyway, there we are.
It's the soundtrack of your youth. That's what it is.
Oh, definitely. And I tell you why, because the video that goes with it is in black and white, and it shows a load of Mary Quaint models, you know, modelling these incredible
Mary
clothes.
Quaint. I like that. That's the old-fashioned version of Mary Quant.
Oh, is it Mary Quant? Yeah, well.
Mary Quaint. I like that.
Mary Quaint. Yeah. Okay, folks, you're listening to Life on Planet Porky. Thank you very much indeed for joining us. Myself and Miss Jones just been getting into the music scene there. But, of course, the music scene isn't the only thing that's happening at the moment, Leslie. And what's happening and dominating our lives is COVID. And I've read a 4-page report on the fact that COVID and lockdown and self-isolating and shielding and all that is playing havoc with all our sleeping patterns, and that we're all going to come out of it very, very different people mentally to the people we were when we went into it. Is this affecting you, Miss Jones?
Very much so, yeah. I'm sleeping very little. Mm-hmm. And I'm having some very weird dreams.
Right.
Quite disturbing dreams. I think a lot of people are having nightmares and so on. Yeah. I had a dream recently about Paul McCartney playing a concert, and I was sitting there with some friends, and it was so detailed that I called up the friend in question the next morning, and I was explaining this dream to him, and he said, "I can't believe what you're saying to me." He said, "I had exactly the same dream."
What?
Yeah.
That is very, very spooky.
I know. It's thrown me, and I'm trying not to think about it too much, because how did that happen?
When your friend told you of his dream, were you in his dream like he was in your dream?
Yes, and I was describing what his girlfriend was wearing, and he described what I was wearing, and then he said, "And Paul McCartney was wearing a lilac shirt," and I said, "Yeah, in my dream, his shirt was mauve."
Well, mauve and lilac are very similar, aren't they?
Yeah, exactly. So it was so odd. It was like we'd both tapped into the same portal or something.
Good God. I mean, that sends shivers down my spine, honestly. I'm not joking. God, blimey.
There is a reason for it, but we don't know what it is.
No, we don't know what it is. So what is the main problem? Is it that you... they say the main problems here are, how can I stop waking up too early? How can I get a deep sleep? How can I fall asleep quickly instead of lying there for hours? How can I cure my insomnia? What if COVID worries are keeping me awake? Do you relate to any of those questions?
All of it, yeah. And last weekend, You Magazine, the Mail on Sunday's colour supplement, did a whole issue about sleep problems.
Well, a lot
everything
of people are doing
in the magazine
at the moment.
Was to do with.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think, I mean, we're all trying the things like drinking chamomile tea, which is very calming, soothing. I've got, there's a brand called This Works of cosmetics that you can buy in Marks & Spencer's, actually. Mm-hmm. You can get it online. Mm-hmm. With some cream that has chamomile and lavender, and you smooth it on your skin and inhale it deeply. You can put these pillow sprays of similar ingredients to try and calm yourself down. But I think we're all not doing enough. We're not going out in the evenings. We're not going and being stimulated by our friends in terms of having conversation, going to see shows. There's no entertainment in our lives, really, apart from television, you know, which is, most of it is dead boring. So you can read a book. Yeah, I've read 10,000 books during the 3 lockdowns.
Yeah.
Okay, write another book. I've done that as well. Mm. You can go out for a walk, but there's not really enough to stretch our brains, I don't think.
Mm. Well, yeah. You see, I'm in a very privileged position because I don't have any loose time. I really don't. Most of my life is made up trying to acquire information all the time, because I have radio shows, as you know, obviously. We do these lovely podcasts, and I don't need information for that, because you and I talk so naturally and so easily, that's fine. But I'm always, I don't know what it is, I'm always thinking, Christ, if somebody rings me up and wants to talk to me about this tomorrow, you know, like a radio show, Jeremy Vine on Radio 2 or something like that, or if GMB ring up and say, do you want to do that? I feel I have to be in charge of every subject at every minute of the day, and I'm kind of obsessed about reading, you know, 4 or 5 newspapers a day, watching lots of news a day, so I never get caught out. That is a bit obsessive, because at my time of life and after the career I've had, I should be much more relaxed about that, but I'm not. I'm frightened of being found out all the time.
Yeah, well, you're a news junkie. You know, we were brought up on news, and that is a habit that never leaves you. My father, in his final years, sort of in his late 80s, was still a news junkie.
Right.
Having worked on Fleet Street all those years.
Yes.
And you never step away from that, because it's in your blood. Yeah. The need to know what's going on. I was talking to a friend yesterday, very sadly. He called to let me know that his wife had been diagnosed with Alzheimer's. Oh, she's only 63.
Golly.
And you think, God, that is way too early. But
yeah.
part of the problem is when people are not exercising their brains enough.
Yeah.
And, you know, these kind of diseases set in. So I think there's also maybe a subliminal terror of letting go of one's mind.
Yeah.
And that's the kind of thing that's driving us to to do all the things that we do.
Yeah, no, you may be right. I've got an absolute obsession about it. First thing I do, obviously, when I get up in the morning is check my phone, switch on three different tellies on three different channels, Sky, BBC, ITV. And I just, you know, if I've missed some world event that happened 2 hours before, I start lashing myself for having not been on the ball and not knowing about it. You know what I mean? And missing out. And I have a dread of something happening which I'm not informed about. But anyway, you're quite right. And I can imagine your dad would probably have watched every minute of every football match ever on TV. And towards the end of his life, there was usually at least one an evening. You know what I mean?
Oh, he was glued to it. He had his own room and his own television because in the main room where my mother will sit and still does, you know, she doesn't want to watch sport all the time. So he had a sport watching room in the end, which is funny. I tell you, the people who are sleeping very well at the moment are those poor people who are homeschooling their kids.
Oh, yeah.
And I was talking to an editor yesterday because I've worked for a newspaper this week and he was saying that it's hell. He said, you have no idea. I said, I feel so sorry for you. He said, you need to feel sorry for me. You have no idea how bad it is.
Yeah, I can imagine. Honestly, it's talk about a nightmare. And of course, the debate goes on. The Prime Minister talking again only this morning. I'm not prepared to review the March the 8th opening day for school. I think schools should be going back a lot sooner than that. But that's quite another debate. Things are going very well with the vaccine. I want the pubs to reopen. I spoke, by the way, to, and I'm sure somebody you'll have interviewed many times, Denise Van Outen this week, okay? And she is actually, in parallel with me, running a campaign to try and get pubs to reopen sooner rather than later. And she's doing it on behalf of Heineken. And she makes all the points that I've made for the mental health of people, for the good of a community, for the wealth of the nation, for the health of the nation. Pubs should be opened sooner rather than later, even with the most onerous restrictions, because they are the fabric of our society and have been for a millennium, you know. And I was right in there with Denise, and we had an awful lot in common, believe me.
Yeah, I bet you did. Yeah, I think it's quite ironic, isn't it, that we're promoting pubs for the health of the nation.
Yes.
Whereas in the past, we might have said, stay out of the pub because you're going to become an alcoholic.
Yeah, well, you say that, but people of my generation, I've had my excess years in pubs. I mean, Christ, you know, we could spend a day talking into a podcast about our experiences in pubs in Fleet Street.
And not only just, a day, maybe a week.
But maybe a week, and not just in Fleet Street, but anywhere where we went for a job, 90% of that time would have been spent in a pub in one form or another, either talking to the people we'd been sent to see or writing up the story or, you know, celebrating the story or, I don't know, you know, keeping in touch through the pub's phone or something like that. But anyway, but, you know, I don't use pubs these days, as you have accepted many times. Thank you, Miss Jones, to go and get plastered. I like pubs because they're pubs and they've been part of my life. And we've talked about that a lot. One place I might think of shooting off to when restrictions are lifted, and I'm quite serious about this, Miss Jones, is the Isle of Man, because the Isle of Man is now fully reopened again. OK, how about that? Isn't that great?
That is amazing. How have they managed to contain it, do you think?
They just completely closed their border. Now, closing the border of the Isle of Man is easy. They've got one main airport and about four ports, OK, which are used for ferries and that kind of stuff. And they just said nobody comes in. And they did it for 3 weeks. They haven't had a single case. They've now reopened. And the scenes I saw this week of people behaving in a pub on the Isle of Man like we used to behave in pubs here, sitting across a table from each other, drinking large gin and tonics, eating food, waving to somebody on the next table, having a beautiful barmaid come up and serve your drinks to the table. Oh, my goodness me, I can't wait to get back to all that.
But, you know, if people start travelling to the Isle of Man, surely that's the way to let cases of COVID in.
Yes, but what they do is when you land in the Isle of Man, you're given a test there and then. And if there's anything wrong with you, you don't get out of the quarantine area at the airport.
Unless you go on a jet ski like that guy who went looking for his girlfriend.
Something very odd about that story. I mean, that was, you know, sold as a romantic story about a bloke who got on jet ski and went, what was it, 15 miles across the Irish Sea to the Isle of Man. Something very, very odd about that. because
he'd never ridden a jet ski in his life before.
And he couldn't swim.
There's more to that.
And I've read a piece saying there's a lot more to this than meets the eye. The fact that she had rung up a photographer to get some pictures taken and all that, you know what I mean? But anyway, look, you know, each to their own. But seriously, if they open that up, I shall get myself up to Liverpool, drive up to Liverpool, and either get the ferry or fly from John Lennon Airport, actually, to Douglas in the Isle of Man. Ronald's Way, it's called, the airport in the Isle of Man. And not only then are you enjoying the benefits of, you know, full bar service and full bar atmosphere, but you know you're amongst the safest people in the world.
Yeah. Oh, well, I might see you there. I've got some very good friends who live on the Isle of Man.
Oh, really?
I tell you who else used to live on the Isle of Man was Rick Wakeman.
Oh, did he? I spoke to him the other day. I told you, didn't I?
Yeah, he doesn't anymore. He lives in Diss in Norfolk now, but he was married to Nina Carter.
Yes.
One of those sort of glamour models, yeah.
Yeah.
And while they were married, they lived on the Isle of Man.
Was Rick the one who's also married to Cher?
No.
Who was that?
That was one of the Allman brothers.
Greg Allman, yeah. That's right. Yeah, Greg Allman, yeah, that's right, yeah.
They had a daughter who became a son.
Oh, right, okay. Well, also, I read that the reason their marriage split up is that Greg Allman literally almost drowned in a bottle in a bowl of soup because he was so heavy into drugs. He lost all functioning in his body, and he's sitting at a table and he slumped forward and he very nearly drowned in a bowl of soup.
They made some fantastic music. I won't deny that, but yeah. I mean their behaviour. They had a manager at one point who used to carry a list in the briefcase. He had photocopies, say like 50 photocopies of this list of the age of consent in all the US states.
What?
So when they travelled on the tour bus,
they
could be aware of whether they'd be breaking the law if they took a particular girl back to their hotel room after the show.
Goodness gracious me. I mean, look, you know, I'm not making any jokes about that. That's disgraceful behaviour. People
Isn't
shouldn't
it?
Get into it, and I don't know. It's a whole new world. Now, talking about eligible men, eligible bachelors, have you got any interest in the life and times of Danny Cipriani? He's doing the rounds now, and he's, you know, talking about, you know, why it never went right for him. He thought he'd been, you know, treated harshly within the game. He had a very active life off the pitch. Has he ever come to your attention?
Vaguely. Isn't he a fly half for fullbacks?
Yeah, I'm not great into rugby. He's a fly half, I think.
He's English, but for some reason he plays for Welsh clubs.
Well, no, he plays for any club who'll have him, really. He played for Sale, I think, was his last one. But he's played for clubs certainly in Australia. And I think he may have played for a club in France. But he's English and he wanted to play for the England side. I think he only got about 7 caps. And a lot of people will say he's 33 now. It's a wasted career, but you've got to be an expert in rugby to work out why his caps are so limited. But really, I'm talking about his life off the field. I mean, he attracted some of the most, you know, some of the best looking and most attractive women in this country, and I can't figure out why. Was it just because he's very handsome? Do you think he's handsome?
I think what it is, most rugby players look like Shrek, don't they? Because they've had so many injuries. They've got cauliflower ears, broken noses, rewired jaws, all the bit. And
like,
they tend to be...
Like Zara's husband, you mean? Mike Tindall?
Yeah. So along...
Although Mike's a very nice guy, by the way. Very nice guy.
Yeah, sweet.
Worked with him. Yeah.
Along every now and again, along comes a good-looking one, like Will Carling or Johnny, what's his name? And... Yeah. So you kind of take notice of a good-looking rugby player, don't you?
I don't, but I know what you mean.
Because they're not common. They're usually the other kind. They're usually Shrek. So, I mean, this guy is young. He's 33. He's not really my type. I can't say. And he doesn't seem to have that much to say for himself. Most sportsmen don't, by the way. It's quite a rare sportsman who has a scintillating personality.
Yeah.
And that's why we take notice of the ones who do.
Yeah, well, Gary Neville has a lot to say. He's a guy really worth listening to, Gary Neville, these days, you know.
Have you read his book?
No.
I bought it for my son for Christmas. Oh. I don't think he's read it either.
Right. Oh, but have you read
it? It's like a. I bought it. I right. haven't read it, but it's like a self-help book, you know.
I see.
How to succeed and to be great. And
sure.
A good sort of timely book to read during these troubled times.
Well, indeed. I tell you what you should do during these troubled times. We should all go and study an atlas, because I read this fantastic report that 1 in 3 Britons would not be able to point out France on a world map. Now,
I mean, absolutely disgusted by that. I really can't believe that at all.
It's got to be a joke, isn't it? Everybody knows France is just the other side of the English Channel, but apparently not. It's our closest neighbour, but 1/3 of Britons cannot find France on a map of the world, a survey has found. I mean, what are we coming to?
I'm really shocked. Did they not do geography at school? I've always been fascinated by maps. I'm that person who sits there on the plane studying the world map in the middle of the in-flight magazine. And I just love looking at maps, where countries are.
Yeah.
I think we all have to be familiar with where our nation sits in the sort of plan of the world, the layout of countries, how and where the planet works, that kind of thing. Yeah. We have to be aware of that kind of thing these days. It's fundamental to who we are.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. In the study, 6,550 adults in the UK were asked to pinpoint 196 countries from all over the globe. Researchers found the second hardest nation to find was Vietnam. Well, I can kind of understand that, because Vietnam really, to most people, is a war, not a country. You know what I mean? And they know it's somewhere like in Southeast Asia. But you'd only have to look into Southeast Asia to realise, oh, well, there's Cambodia, there's Laos. That must be Vietnam, you know?
You can say roughly where those places are. Indonesia, you know where that is.
Yeah.
The Philippines, you know Japan. I mean, they've said Japan is one of the places. Everybody knows where Japan is, surely.
Yeah, yeah. Well,
I think if you gave, if you went out into the street and gave most people a map of the world, a flat plan map, and said, you know, mark where all these countries are, I find it very hard to believe that most people wouldn't know where most countries are.
Yeah, I totally agree. It says number 10 was Canada. Well, Canada, I think, has got the largest landmass in the world. Only about 13% of it's inhabited. But how can you not find Canada when you know it's just actually north of the United States of America?
You can't miss Canada, can you?
No. I tell you what is funny, though, these days. Since the Soviet Union broke up, of course, an awful lot of new countries came online, for want of a better word. You know what I mean? And then the Balkans broke up. OK, Yugoslavia broke up. And so I have to admit, I have travelled to countries, you know, following England, the football team, or doing jobs there, you know, like tournament games and all that kind of stuff. And I genuinely have got on aeroplanes not knowing where I was going. I spoke to Andy Townsend, gave me a ring once. He was away on a job with ITV and we had to meet up when he got back. And he said, I'll be back either Thursday or Friday. I said, OK. I said, where are you then? He said, oh, I'm doing the game, the Champions League game in Montenegro. And I said, oh, OK. I said, just remind me where Montenegro is, Andy. He said, oh, I don't know. I haven't got a clue. But I mean, he was there. You know what I mean? But honestly, an awful lot of that happened after it broke up. We used to get on planes at Heathrow and Gatwick, flying to places. We don't have a clue where we were flying to because nobody bothered to look up. I mean, you know, we couldn't. We landed once and got busy on a story about 4 hours into the story. I thought we were in Serbia, but we were in Croatia. And the production team I was with had the other way around. They thought we were in Croatia, but had gone to Serbia. And it did get very confusing.
Yeah, I think these political boundaries which change, we've seen the same thing in African countries. I'm often shocked to hear from certain people that they think Africa is a country rather than a continent and don't realise that it is actually a collection of countries within a continent as, you know, as Europe is or as anywhere else. But I think political boundaries do confuse things a little bit because countries change their names.
Yeah.
So you've got to keep abreast of it, really. You've got to read the international pages of newspapers.
Yes, you have. I totally agree. I mean, for instance, but the other daft thing is people keep changing the names of countries. So, you know, for about 3 or 4 days.
I just said that.
Oh, did you? Sorry, the names. Yeah, I'm sorry, Mr. Jones. I must pay more attention when you're speaking. But, you know, for 2 or 3 days, I was watching the news and, you know, quite fascinated by all this rioting going on in Myanmar, you know. And then I thought, I wonder where Myanmar is, only to find out it's actually Burma, you know.
Yeah, it's one place my father always wanted to go, actually, because the aforementioned Uncle Bert is buried there.
Yeah.
And we have a photograph of his cross with his number on it, but we were never able to go out there. It was closed for many years anyway.
Yes.
Foreigners couldn't come into to Burma.
Yeah.
But you wouldn't want to go to Myanmar right now anyway.
No, you certainly wouldn't. I totally agree. Most famous one for me was after China changed the name of their capital from Peking to Beijing, the rest of the world very slow to catch up on this, you know. And then, of course, there was the famous Tiananmen Square. And a great friend of mine, Ted Oliver, who was a Mail reporter. Did you know Ted, Northern Irish?
Yeah, I remember him, yes.
Yeah, lovely guy, honestly, terrific reporter and all that. He was working for the Mirror in those days. And they sent him to China. So, and, you know, communications weren't great in those days. We didn't have mobile phones. But eventually, the news editor of the Mirror, a guy called Tom, he was a very nice guy, but he was a bit dense, you know what I mean? As a news editor, he wasn't quite with it. He sort of gets a phone call at home, you know, in Buckinghamshire or somewhere, and it's a crackly line, you know, Tom, it's Ted here, it's Ted. I finally got here. I got in it. Four different flights, 36 hours, but I'm here. And Tom said, oh, that's great, Ted. And so where exactly are you? I'm in Beijing. I've actually got here. I'm in the capital in Beijing. And Tom said, right. And now how long will it take you to get from there to Peking? Because he didn't realise that it was the same place.
Same place.
Yeah.
And interesting.
A lot of that going on in those days.
Well, right. Do you remember? I mean, Ceylon was a place when we were at school, which became Sri Lanka.
Sri Lanka, that's right.
And
yeah.
I think a lot of people didn't keep up with that. You know, I think people just need to keep themselves informed throughout their lives. Learning doesn't stop when we leave school.
No, I agree. The problem is some of the broadcasting companies are so politically correct. You'll have a reporter standing there with a microphone and a caption along it, which says, this is, you know, Fred Scuttle in, where was the famous one? Somewhere in India, a famous Indian, Bombay, right? But there was a sign behind this guy, you know, which said, welcome to Bombay. But the caption alongside the bottom of the screen had a name of another city because Bombay's been renamed something else, isn't it?
It's Mumbai now, but...
Mumbai, that's right, yeah, Bombay.
What's very interesting is that elderly people, I'm in touch with a couple of elderly people in India because of research for my new Freddie Mercury book.
Oh, right.
And they still refer to their capital as Bombay.
Right.
It is still Bombay in their eyes.
Yeah, amazing. And always will be to them, of course. So there we go. Right. OK, Miss Jones. Well, thank you very much indeed. Thank you to all our millions of listeners. Thank you not just for listening today, but thank you also, Leslie Ann, for the great responses we get to these podcasts. It makes worthwhile them doing, does it not?
Do you know, I so look forward to reading my Twitter feed because we get such great feedback from our listeners and really funny as well. Some people who get in touch are just, you have a real great banter with them, you know. Yeah. It makes my day. Please keep them coming.
Indeed. Okay, folks, so until next time, please all stay safe. Leslie Ann, you take care of yourself as well, and we'll be talking again soon. This guy's mother was Jane Asher, who married the very, very famous cartoonist, Gerald Scarfe.
Ah, okay. Absolutely.
And I was stunned, and I actually said, and I apologised later, I said, what? I said, so in a parallel universe, you could be Paul McCartney's son. He said, yes, in a parallel universe, but I'm not. I'm very grateful to be Gerald Scarfe and Jane Asher's son, you know?
Yeah, that's probably quite an offensive thing to say to him.
Well,
you know, your dad's no good. You'd have done much better with Paul McCartney.
Exactly. That's what I thought. I thought, I rang him up later and I said, look, Donald.
Sorry about that.
Yeah, I said, look, I'm sorry. I said, I've just been such a beaten fan all my life. I'm sitting there looking at a man whose father could have been Paul McCartney, but wasn't. And it made it, so you're absolutely right. It made it sound like I'd said to this bloke, oh, golly, you really messed up your life. Well, your mother's messed up your life for you, hasn't she? You know.
Keep digging, Porky, is the answer to that,
Exactly.
I think political boundaries do confuse things a little bit because countries change their names.
Yeah.
So you've got to keep abreast of it, really. You've got to read the international pages of newspapers.
Yes, you have. I totally agree. I mean, for instance, but the other daft thing is people keep changing the names of countries. So, you know, for about 3 or 4 days...
I just said that.
Oh, did you? Sorry, the names. Yeah, I'm sorry, Mr. Jones. I must pay more attention. I think.
Yeah, what was all that about? What did you mean on Twitter when you said, I wouldn't make passes at men who wear glasses?
Oh, well, you know...
Complete misquote, Porky, by the way.
Well, that's... a complete misquote is sometimes quite good.